The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank.
Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work and fierce determination have changed society, lives and the world in all kinds of amazingly inspiring ways. In each episode, we'll be talking to an extraordinary woman about the experiences that led her to create the organisation, found the charity, launch the campaign, or raise the profile of an issue that she simply couldn't sit by and allow to go unnoticed or unserved. We'll discover what motivates and moves her, the challenges she's faced, the joys she's experienced, the plans she has, and the lessons she's learnt along the way. We'll also hear the sometimes funny and surprising answers to the four quickfire questions we ask each one of our extraordinary ordinary women. I'm Diane Kenwood. I'm a journalist, broadcaster and blogger, and I'm one of the presenters of this very special podcast. Later on, the other member of our gang, Leonie Mellinger, will be talking to one of the Women of the Year lunch guests who you most certainly will have heard of, about what makes the event such a very special and inspiring experience. Now for this week's guests. In the celebrity seat, we have none other than the magnificent Dame Joan Bakewell, who we're thrilled is joining us and you'll be hearing from later on. And this week's Extraordinary Ordinary Woman is someone who has had a huge impact on the lives of homeless people living on the streets and the pets they're devoted to. She has started this incredible charity called Street Paws, which helps to support homeless people and their pets in whatever circumstances they find themselves. And I do say pets, well, companions, advisedly, because as you'll hear, they're not just dogs.
First of all, I just wanted to start off, Michelle, and other than by saying it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you. And actually, we have just seen each other for the first time because we've spoken lots of times, haven't we? But we've never actually seen each other.
Yes, that's right. We're like friends who haven't met yet, but I'm sure we will at some point cross.
I'm coming up to you. I want to see Street Paws in action. But before we start talking about it, I'm intrigued to know whether animals, pets, particularly dogs, have always been a part of your life.
Absolutely. We've always had family dogs, apart from one period where we sadly lost a dog and we couldn't bring ourselves quite to welcome another one into the family. We did, after a short gap, I have to say, we've always had dogs. They've always been a part of our lives as a family.
And are they always the same type of dog?
No. I used to work in a vet, so anybody who works in a vet will tell you acquire animals while you're there. We've had Labradors in the past in the family. We had a little crossbreed when I was a child growing up, who I loved dearly. We've welcomed a Labradoodle into our home 12 years ago. She is 12 now. She's fabulous. And 6 years ago, I inherited via work a little Jack Russell Terrier. We're very diverse, yes.
Fantastic. And I suppose it's an invidious question, a bit like saying, what's your favourite child? Do you have a favourite breed?
I have to say, it's fast becoming the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, because they're just such wonderful dogs. Most of our clients will benefit from the company of a lovely Staffy. Through their difficult paths in their lives, and they're just fabulous companions. They really won me over.
Isn't that interesting? Because they don't have a great reputation, do they? There's some work to be done there to persuade people that's the case with their character.
Definitely, and I think a lot of that's down to sometimes the media perception of the dog and the breed. But they're the most loving, friendly, chatty little dogs you could ever meet. Fabulous.
Right, let's talk about Street Paws. So let's go back to that time when you were working in the vet's practice, and you were also doing some volunteering during that period, weren't you?
I was, yes. I was volunteering with a little soup kitchen in Newcastle who used to go out weekly and hand out food. So I just went along one night and to hand out the food, and I saw a dog. And I could tell the owner loved the dog very much, but there wasn't really any services or provision in place for the animal. Like I say, I was working in a vet's, and I thought I couldn't stop thinking about that dog all night. Went into work the next day and persuaded a vet to come with me the following week.
Blimey, it was literally that quick. So one dog, one thought, and you were off and running.
Yes, literally that quick. And, you know, I just said, can you come out with me next week to the kitchen? There's a little dog there, and I'd really just like you to check the dog over and make sure it's okay.
I would say certainly in London, where I live, unfortunately, homeless people are a very normal sight on the streets. But certainly homeless people who have dogs are an equally normal thing for you to see. What sort of percentage of homeless people have dogs as companions and pets?
Well, the statistics, I think, in all honesty, there hasn't really been a lot of research done around it. But the general consensus from all the reports that have been written up to now is that there's approximately 1 in 10 homeless people will have a companion animal with them.
You started off with this one vet coming with you to the homeless shelter. Take us on the sort of journey as to how Street Paws grew from that.
Yeah, so we went the following week and the dog wasn't there, quite annoyingly, because I was full of, enthusiasm. So I think we waited about 3 visits before we actually saw an animal. And the first animal we actually saw was a ferret with the charity.
Clyde. A ferret?
Yeah.
Oh, Clyde, he had a name.
He does have a name. He was a local celebrity, often seen walking around the streets of Newcastle on a little harness. So we quickly became friends with Clyde, who needed nothing much than his nails clipped it. You know, on the odd occasion, but quickly won over the team, you know, the veterinary team. And then as we were talking about what we were doing in work, the veterinary community is very close-knit. Everybody knows everybody. And word spread, and then everybody decided they wanted to also be involved, which is wonderful. I was just in the right place at the right time, I think, to have the connections.
So how did it actually work at the start? Did you literally just go out onto the streets with a vet?
Yes, we went with the kitchen that I was volunteering with. So they were there providing food and sleeping bags and clothing, and we just stood at the side with the vet. It took a few weeks, like I say, and then people started to come, you know, talk about what we were doing. The word got around, and then we started to see the very first dogs. It was very much challenging at the beginning, because you've got to remember these people have lost everything, and their dog is all they have. So they're very fiercely protective. And I think at the beginning, they were just, the ultimate worry was that the vet was going to examine their dog and say they weren't doing a good job looking after them. And I think a lot of them thought we were there to, you know, to take the dogs away. So we spent months building trust in the first instance, and we still do that in new areas, because, you know, they'll quite rightly tell, you know, rightly or wrongly, they'll say to you, oh, my dog sees a vet. But, you know, that's not quite true. But, you know, it's just building the relationship with the person as well.
Yeah, because it actually, that relationship between a homeless person and their animal, and I did refer to the dog as a pet earlier, but actually that's not really right, isn't it? That animal is a companion to that homeless person and really important, plays a really important role in their lives.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, you know, when the person's absolutely rock bottom and they're sleeping on the streets because they have nothing, their animal and their pet and their best friend is the dog, and that's all they have to, you know, to cling on to. Sometimes the dog doesn't care that they don't have a house to live in, because the dog is with that owner who they love. They get fed, they get exercised, and they're kept warm at night together in a sleeping bag. It's the human who suffers being on the street because of the animal, because it's quite restricting, you know, to get to access services because you have a pet. But ultimately, the dogs don't judge. The dog doesn't judge any mistakes they might have made. The dog doesn't care. The dog just wants their love. And I think that's why that bond is so strong. It also gives the person a sense of responsibility, because if anything happens, that, you know, if they were arrested for, say, or, you know, they become ill, then what happens to the dog? And so it gives them a responsibility, and they have to actually provide things for the dog, like food and shelter. So it gives them some sense of normality too.
Yeah, and you've said that you've seen more than one instance where a homeless person has given food to their dog before themselves.
Oh, countless, every time. every time I've been on outreach and I've been having a conversation with somebody, and somebody from the public will walk past and offer a sandwich quite often, and the person who takes the sandwich will open it and give it to the dog first, because the dog is the most important single thing in their life at that point.
And how, without Street Paws, have homeless people managed to take care of their dogs? Because, you know, animals do need attention, and sometimes that's medical attention and things like, just like you said with the ferret, clipping their claws. So how have they previously managed to do that?
I really don't know, because, you know, unless you, even the charity vets, you need access to benefits to be, you know, accepted into their systems and fit their criteria. So I honestly don't know, but people might be surprised to know that rough sleepers and homeless people with dogs, the dogs are in really good health. There's not really much that we need to, other than the general vaccination, flea and worming, and microchips, there's very little intervention that we generally need to provide, because the dogs are super healthy.
Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Gosh, that's absolutely not what you'd expect, is it?
No.
That's amazing. So you've gone from, you've headed out onto the streets with your vet companions, and is each vet always accompanied by a volunteer from Street Paws?
Well, the Street Paws vets are our Street Paws volunteers. We usually have a small team. I mean, obviously during the pandemic, we've had to adapt that, but On a normal night, there will be probably two vets, a vet nurse, attend each area. We always go in the first week of every month, and we stay with the same service that we link with, the homeless service, so people generally know where they're going to find us.
Yeah, so you go out with the homeless service, you accompany them to provide the extra service for the animals. Okay, so we've taken a bit of a leap from you and a couple of vets going out on the streets to an organisation that's now been going for, is it 5 years?
It is, yeah, 5 years this year.
Amazing, amazing. Were you taken by surprise at how it grew?
Absolutely. I never, you know, from this one idea I had to try and help one dog, I never in a million years thought it would turn into the charity it is today.
So tell us about exactly what it is today and what services you provide and where.
So we continued in Newcastle for probably about 8 or 9 months, and then word started to get around the veterinary industry, and there was lots of vets. Because vets, you have to remember that the whole life is around animals and provide and relief from animal suffering. So the vets are super keen to be involved, which is wonderful for us as a charity. So we quickly spread out across different locations. We started in York and then quite quickly followed by Leeds and Manchester. At the moment, we're currently work across the northeast, northwest, Yorkshire, Cardiff, and we've got a post in Belfast in Northern Ireland. And it's the same every month. The vet teams will go out with their vet bags on the streets and they provide a veterinary service for the animals who present to us at the outreach. A couple of years ago, I realised that it was really difficult for people who, it was a conversation with an animal welfare officer in Manchester, because there was a homeless person sat in an ambulance refusing treatment for himself because he had a dog. They couldn't take the dog in the ambulance and he wouldn't leave without knowing that his dog was safe.
Oh no.
Yeah. So she rang me in a panic and said, could we take the dog to Manchester Dogs Home? So we set up a service for emergency kennel space. So exactly for that instance, so that if somebody needed to go to hospital or access services, they could take the dogs into kennels, into our care. And then we keep the dogs until they can be reunited, which has been amazing service. And this last year, because of the pandemic, it really helped us in a weird way, because we've been fighting for 2 years really to have dogs accepted into hostels, because I think a lot of people don't realise that there's less than 10% of hostels will let you take your dog with you. So that leaves the homeless dog owner at a disadvantage to access services, and more often than not, they're asked to give up the pet.
Let's Oh, that, I mean, that just breaks my heart to even think about. And especially when, you know, as you said before, the dog is such a vital part of a homeless person's life and ability to manage life out on the streets. So let's talk about the pandemic, shall we? Because obviously one of the things that the government said was they needed all homeless people to be housed so they weren't on the streets. Now, that's a challenge enough in itself. But as you've just said, there's only 10% of homeless facilities that will take dogs. What on earth happened? What did you do to help all those devoted homeless dog owners to get off the streets and into accommodation?
The first response from many local authorities was, well, we have a responsibility to you, but not to the animal, which left that person, you know, in such a difficult position, because they realised that they needed to get in and be safe and, you know, from the pandemic, but they wouldn't give up the dog. And I, you know, quite rightly, and why should they be asked to give up the dog? So our immediate response as a charity was to reach out to a network of private boarding kennels, because people weren't using their service at that time because everybody was in a lockdown. And we quite quickly, within a couple of days, set up a network where when we were receiving a call from any area, we could take the dog into a kennel and pay for them to stay there.
Wow. But then that's the homeless person separated from their dogs at a time when, God knows, we all needed all the comfort that we could possibly find. So was that a sustainable way of managing that situation?
It was a first step, and it was an immediate response to the crisis. Still, we found that lots of people just wouldn't go, because exactly, they wouldn't give up the pet, not even for a night. So we quickly worked, we seized the opportunity really to sell the service of our dog champion scheme. And thankfully, a few of the local authorities snapped up the offer, and we started working that way.
Right, so explain dog champion scheme, please.
So dog champion scheme evolved because we were having numerous conversations with many hostel providers, and we were asking, you know, why won't you accept a dog? What are the reasons behind that? And the general feeling we got from the research we did was that it was generally down to the worried that the dog was going to become ill. It was going to cause fights with if other animals were staying at the property. If they were going to have fleas, if the person was going to abandon their dog and what would happen then, or it was just staff, you know, weren't used to having dogs or hadn't had dogs in their lives and just were just a bit unsure about how to respond and, you know, manage a dog in a property. So we developed the dog champion scheme, and under the scheme, we support hostels to become pet friendly. So Street Paws will offer anybody who joins the scheme full staff training and support. So we offer behaviour training, how to recognise behaviour in dogs.
I take it this is behaviour training for the humans.
For the staff,
the dogs.
Yes. For the staff. Yes. How to settle the dog into the property, because some of these dogs have been out on the streets for a long time with their owner 24/7. So then they're coming into a room in a hostel and it's totally alien to them as well. So just to really ease the dog and the owner into the hostel and into the accommodation with, you know, as least problems or disruption as possible. We offer full veterinary care and support. That's 24/7. So if there's any issues, the staff ring us immediately and we arrange to get that dog to a vet. We provide all the necessary vaccinations, flea and worming, microchipping, neutering, which is recommended. We also provide dog welcome packs. So they've got all the equipment that they need to have pets in the property. So the dog bowls, leads, collars, dog tags, and they're registered as Street Paws patients when they arrive. So it's just really a package to encourage more people to take dogs into their accommodations. And it's working really well.
Honestly, Michelle, I'm just stunned at the amount that you're doing and that you've achieved. And I mean, this started just you and one vet. So there must be more than just you running it now, surely.
There's two of us.
Oh, two. Goodness, like not for that. Oh my God.
And I still answer the phone every day to all the calls to the charity.
Oh, blimey, Michelle. So you were working in a vet. I'm taking it you're not working in the vet anymore.
No, about a year into the charity, I just took a leap of faith because I knew this was my heart and my passion, and I just needed to do something to change the situation for these people and their animals. So I left my job and I volunteered for the charity for a couple of years just to build it up.
And how are you funding all of this?
I became very skilled in the art of fundraising from not knowing anything at all. I did have some support from fundraising volunteers as well at the beginning because I didn't have a clue. And I just got the story out about what we were doing and applied to trusts.
Goodness me. So on top of overseeing, running, delivering all the services that Street Paws does, answering the phones, you are also raising all the money that is needed to keep this going.
Yes. Sounds scary when you say it like that.
Frankly, it sounds scary saying it. That's absolutely yes. Unbelievable, Michelle. I mean, when you sort of stand back and look at where you're at now, 5 years on, how does that make you feel?
Oh, just so proud. And, you know, everybody on the streets has got a story, and it's usually very sad. And honestly, the times we've been in tears together over the years, and it just motivates me to just hold everybody to account and just say this is not acceptable and try and make a change.
What do you see? I mean, this is a huge question, and obviously it doesn't have an absolutely simple, straightforward answer, but because of what you've learned about the causes of homelessness and what happens to people that means they end up on the street, where do you think the fixes need to happen so that people aren't ending up in those situations?
I think there needs to be something set up prior to that, the actual eviction or the point where the person can't cope anymore, with their own mental health issues or addiction problems, and they end up rough sleeping, which absolutely, hats off to anybody. I've done it a couple of times as a charity fundraiser in a secure, place that's locked away, not in the middle of a city, dealing with everything that's going on, in a city overnight. And I've felt so alone, cold, miserable and vulnerable. Hats off to anybody who could even manage to survive one night out on the streets with nothing. I just don't know how they do it.
And are you seeing, with the people whose animals you're looking after, are you seeing the same people for long, long periods of time?
Yes, sadly.
Oh, God, that's heartbreaking, isn't it? And what are, again, the other end of that issue is, what are the things that can be put in place to get people out of the cycle of homelessness and off the streets?
Well, I'm hoping the Dog Champion scheme is going to expand across the UK nationally this year, end of this year, beginning next. And just my dream for the charity would be so that nobody ends up actually on the street. So if somebody's in the position where they need to, unfortunately they become homeless, they lose their home, then they've got somewhere to go straight away with a dog, and they can access services, on that first or second day, and be supported back into, what we would class as a normal life in a home or a secure accommodation. The scheme with the Dog Champion scheme were piloted over the winter in Manchester with Andy Burnham's team for the Bed Every Night scheme. And they opened up one of the youth hostels as a winter night shelter. And for the first time ever, we had 8 dogs staying there with their owners, which was wonderful. And I think virtually all of them now are in their own permanent accommodation. So it does work.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
It does work. We heard just yesterday, another one of our friends, Liam, and his dog, Stanley, has just signed for his own flat as well. So it does work when people are supported and, they're given the support they need.
Oh, honestly, what you're doing, Michelle, is just stunning. It's stunning. And you've said that, you feel this is your life's work and you want to devote yourself to doing this. And you've talked a bit about what you want to see happening. Do you have big grand plans for Street Paws, or is it something that you're happy to sort of let unfold as you see what is required?
A bit of both, I think, because we're very reactive and we manage to work really quickly to situations, and I guess we just don't know what's going to come up in the future. But I guess the plan for me and how I would like to see the charity develop is to be working with all the big accommodation providers and giving somebody the chance to not have to be remaining on the street just because they have nowhere to go because they have a dog. I think everybody deserves a safe space to sleep, whether you've got a dog or not. So, you know, that's our ultimate goal, I think, moving forward.
Yeah. And it would be remiss of me, after everything we've talked about, not to say to you, how can anyone who might want to get involved with Street Paws, either by volunteering or by donating, yes, please, where do they find you?
Yeah, so I think probably the easiest and the best place to find information and volunteer or donate would be through our website, and that's streetpaws.co.uk.
Oh, that's nice and simple. Now, you are on this podcast, The Extraordinary Ordinary, because you were recognised for the amazing work you've done by Women of the Year. Tell us a bit what that was like for you. What was it like being part of the event? And of course, you were an invitee last year when, because of the pandemic, the event had to be online. So it was quite different from the usual Women of the Year lunch. So what was it like for you?
It was a total honour, a total shock and a total surprise that somebody could recognise the work that I was doing and want to, you know, give a reward for that. I just think I'm just a normal person who just sees opportunity and wants to help. So it was a huge honour and a surprise. Yes, it was online. Yes, there were technical difficulties, but it didn't really detract from the enjoyment for me. I met some wonderful people who were in my little group of people. We had a lovely afternoon and it was wonderful.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, blinking technical problems, but hey ho.
Well, it's
we just
life
live
now,
with them,
isn't
don't
it?
We? It absolutely is. God, it'll be nice when life gets back completely to normal. But you've done an amazing thing through the pandemic to keep your services going and to do what you did. Now, Michelle, before we finish, we ask all our guests on this podcast the same four questions, which I'm going to ask you now. The first one of which is, who is or are the women who have most inspired you in your life?
That seems the most obvious question, but for me, I find that the hardest. There are so many inspirational women, which is amazing. But I think thinking about it, it would have to be Mary Wallace Funk. At 82, she was the oldest person to visit space with Jeff Bezos and his team. And her backstory was she trained as an astronaut in 1961, but she was never allowed space flight because she was a woman. And I just think for her at 82 to achieve that, it just gives a real message, you know, just don't give up.
That's it. I couldn't agree more. Never give up on your dreams. Never.
No. And, she, you know, the first when she landed and, you know, there were obviously the reporters were asking her and, you know, and she said, when can I do it again? And please make it soon. Yeah, she's just I think she's just wonderful.
Oh, what a fantastic answer. That's brilliant. I love that, Michelle. OK, so the next question, what message would you give your younger self?
I've got a sign on my desk, which my family bought me because I'm often, I'm very into self-motivation and I spend a lot of time encouraging my children to be positive and happy. And I've got a sign on my desk that says, thank God I'm fabulous. So that's just, it's a bit of a cheeky reminder that to always be fabulous. So I guess my message to me as a younger self would be, you're fabulous, go and enjoy your life.
I love you, Michelle. Right. What is the one thing you can't live without?
You probably know this. It's dogs. It's got to be dogs. They're wonderful.
I'd have been so disappointed if you hadn't said dogs.
It's got to be dogs every day over everything.
And you have now currently two. You have two at the moment.
We have, currently, yes.
Currently.
Yes, we have two.
Fantastic. And finally, Michelle, what's the one thing about you that would surprise people?
I've got two, actually. I used to be really painfully shy as a younger person, and most people think I'm an extrovert now. So, yeah, that might be a surprise. But I think the quite naughty one is that I ditched school when I was a teenager to go and see David Bowie in concert. And my parents only found out when I was probably about 40. So, yeah, that's a naughty one.
Outrageous. How was it? What was the concert like?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. I would do it all again. I think the funniest thing was actually owning up.
How come you left it until you were 40 to tell them?
I wasn't brave enough to tell my dad. He still wasn't happy.
Even all that time later, he's still telling you off for doing it.
Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Oh, Michelle, it's been such an absolute joy talking to you. Thank you so much for being our guest on The Extraordinary Ordinary and for just being extraordinary and absolutely fabulous.
Thank you.
My goodness, isn't what Michelle's achieved fantastic? Hello, I'm Leonie Mellinger. I run my own business as a communication skills advisor, and I'm an actor. Now, it's my huge pleasure to welcome journalist, presenter, and Labour Party peer Dame Joan Bakewell, who shares her memories of the early days of Women of the Year lunch and her thoughts about why it's still so relevant and important. I asked Joan about her first experience of Women of the Year and what her expectations were.
Well, it is a long time ago, so my memory is quite dim, but I do remember, first of all, being invited and thinking, hello, what's this? What's going on? How wonderful. And turning up for an event at lunchtime at the Savoy. And I do remember the BBC thought of it as news. They saw it as a news item. And I remember being stopped by a crew. Of course, the crews had heavy cameras in those days and lighting and all that kind of thing. Could we have a word? Why are you here? What's the point of it? Do we need it? Why are you? And they were slightly aggressive. They were not rude, but they wanted to know, what on earth is this going? We don't need this kind of thing, do we? And I remember thinking, what are you asking? Of course we do. Of course we do. And isn't it wonderful? Strangely enough, the memory I have is locked into the fact that I was wearing a particular dress, which I liked. And I remember thinking, oh, I wonder how this will look. So quite clearly, in those days, our looks were one of our preoccupations.
And what was the atmosphere like in the room? And what sort of, do you remember what sort of women were there?
No, I don't. I remember being very impressed by them all because they were all, they all had, you know, strength of character, resources. And we were all rather amazed to be seeing each other. We were all very pleased. It was all kind of, oh, what's this do? What's this about? What landmark is this? Because it seemed a good landmark, you know. We'd lived through many different ones. I mean, some of the older people, there must have been some suffragettes there. I mean, I had been interviewing suffragettes in the 60s who were then in their 80s, you see. I can't vouchsafe that to be so, but there were impressive women of a certain age. I was must have been in my 20s then. And I just thought, what an amazing cohort of people we are. Fancy bringing us all together. What a marvellous move that is.
Do we still need an event that celebrates women in this way?
Well, I think the general tenor of the meetings from year to year has changed. Initially, we did see ourselves as part of a spearhead, a crusade to demonstrate that women could do these things. So I think we were conscious, although we perhaps didn't speak of it very much, of the onward tide of women making it in the world. And it was a celebration of that being in process. Whereas now, you could say that we don't need it as much because, of course, women have penetrated all areas of public life. But I think there's more need to celebrate that in order to encourage younger people who haven't yet seen how effective women can be in the world and need to be encouraged to take that role. So I also think there's a great excuse for a good party. You know, we do like meeting each other. We do enjoy each other's company. And I think that's really important because we're often, all of us, so busy, we don't get to meet people in other areas of life. So I haven't ever met a shepherdess. And I'm pleased to be sitting next to a medical consultant or, you know, someone who is a carer in a care home, because I don't normally meet those sort of people. So it's a good place for us all to mix together. The other thing I remember was that it was white. There may well have been one or two people of colour, but it was obviously at the time, as events like that were, people of achievement in jobs, it was primarily white. I don't think that's necessarily so anymore.
It's hugely diverse now in the room. The atmosphere is completely wonderful. In fact, I remember you remarking on that to me last time we were in the room. I think what all of this shows is that we do need to carry on having the Women of the Year event, and it is to celebrate women across the board.
I think not just celebrate them, but also bring them together to enjoy each other's company and find out about each other's way of life, you know. I find that the most exciting thing about arriving. I wonder where I'll be sitting. Who will I meet? Who will I meet up with after many years? I think all of that's part of the enjoyment of it and what women look forward to.
The Extraordinary Ordinary was brought to you by Women of the Year. To find out more about the organisation and its history, the lunch and the Women of the Year awards, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk or find us on Instagram and Twitter at Women of Year. For more information about or to support Street Paws, go to streetpaws.co.uk or find them on Instagram at streetpawsbet. Many thanks to our brilliant producer Claire Lynch, and of course to you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please share these extraordinary, ordinary women with your friends and family. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank. For nearly 40 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of innovative businesses and their investors move bold ideas forward fast. With tailored financial services and expertise, Silicon Valley Bank helps address the unique needs of the innovation ecosystem across all business stages. Learn more at svb.com/UK. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.